AM on April 26th. We're here at the headquarters of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. My name's Bart DeZevi. I'm with the FCIC, and this is Scott Kanz. He's also with the FCIC. And we're here this afternoon to interview Randall Brown.
Randolph.
Oh, excuse me, Randolph. If we could have the other participants from the Federal Reserve identify themselves for the record.
Shari Leventhal from New York Fed Legal.
Kristen Stern, New York Fed Legal.
So we're with the FCIC. I assume you know a little bit about us. We were created by Congress to investigate the financial crisis writ large and to report on a number of things, including the circumstances of the large institutions that failed and the large institutions that would have failed but for extraordinary federal assistance. That's where Citigroup falls into the bucket. We're supposed to issue a report to the President of the United States and Congress by December 15th of this year. So we're going around and interviewing folks not only here at the Federal Reserve Bank, but at the Board of Governors, at the OCC, at the OTS, at private institutions. And we're having hearings as well. And all this work gets compiled and eventually put into one handy-dandy book for everyone to read.
Encyclopedia.
So this isn't an adversarial process like a deposition, but I've got a couple documents here. I'm going to ask you some questions. If I'm not asking what you think the right question is, because you know this better than I do, tell me what the right question is and go ahead and answer it yourself.
Okay.
And, you know, Shari helps me too once in a while. So, just as a reminder, since we're federal government commission, there's a part of Title 18 of the U.S. Code that covers us the same way it covers you guys. So if anyone attempts to mislead us, it invokes criminal penalties as well. So why don't we start with just your background. Why don't you tell me from when you first started in the Federal Reserve System until today what your various responsibilities have been.
Okay. I've actually been with the Federal Reserve 16 years. My 17th anniversary will be in August. I started my career at the Philadelphia Fed in 93. Worked there about 8 years and transferred to New York Fed, specifically working on the Citigroup CPC team right around September 11th, literally the day before September 11th. Initially, I was the ops risk coordinator, or one of the operational risk coordinators, until the summer / fall of 2002, and then I assumed responsibility for the market and liquidity risk coordinator role. I did that up until August / September of 2005. And then I became a member of our funding and liquidity risk team, and then assumed team leader responsibilities right before the crisis in 2008, the summer of 2008.
So why don't you give me some background about Citi when you first went there in 2001 through 2005, there were some rather high-profile events that occurred. The Dr. Evil bond trading,
yes,
kerfuffle. The issue with Japan,
right,
the private bank, and you know, there was. One of the reasons that Chuck Prince was brought in was to sort of beef up internal controls and risk management and all that. So before we get into the sort of 05 era, why don't you tell me about what your sort of exposure to Citi was in your areas of expertise and what you saw and what you learned about Citi.
Right. One of the reasons I was brought up to the Citi, what we call it, to the Central Point of Contact team, was that at the Philadelphia Fed, I was a part of a small group that looked at Citibank Overseas Investment Corporation. And as part of that, I had done a lot of reviews, not only overseas, but also helping out the CPC team. So I had done reviews in corporate compliance, reg reporting, the audit function. So in our lexicon, that's considered operational risk. And because of that experience, that's why I was brought in, because Citi at the time, we were probing a lot into their operational risk issues, trying to get a better sense of what they were going to do in relation to capital to account for the risk in the operational side. And because I had done, like to think, good work, they brought me in to help out. So I was sort of a swingman helping out in a lot of different areas. And so in 2002, there was, I guess you may have heard, the Enron structured credit-related activities. So the person that was actually doing market risk at the time got called to work on that review. And then that's when I assumed the market risk liquidity duties. I would say from 2002 through, I'll say to the middle of late of 2004, market risk at Citi did not pose a lot of risk, and based on the information we were seeing from the MIS reporting coming from the firm. And when I say not a lot of risk, I think the aggregate VAR at the time was low 100s. It might have ticked up a couple million to 125 million a couple times. But overall, it did not seem as though the organization as a whole was taking a lot of market risk, and traditionally as we would see it. Lo and behold, after they had had a number of compliance-related issues that was not necessarily in my area, I guess the Japan issue, and some folks in Europe decided that they were going to short bonds on the electronic trading systems. And when they did that, it almost became one more notch in terms of, you know, look at these compliance issues, and then they then do this issue as well. So I would say from late 2004 through the middle of 2005, majority of my time was dealing with this issue, interfacing with the UK FSA, who ultimately had jurisdiction over the trade, working with them to understand what they were finding, trying to get to whether or not it was technically market manipulation. And ultimately, they decided to fine the firm roughly $25 million. And so during that time, you can imagine seniors here wanted to know exactly the extent of the problem, who did what, and so I was reporting on the efforts that Citi was doing in order to try to identify whether or not this was systemic or this was brought in and just some rogue traders deciding. It was determined that it was just some rogue traders trying to do, trying to make money in a tough environment. But then following that, we were trying to get a sense of, okay, this is a rogue trader. What are you doing now to make sure that others don't get bright ideas like that? And that was a lot of what we were doing in early 2005, is exactly what was management's response to that, and how were they going to ensure that it didn't happen again.
Right. Yeah. So when that settlement with the FSA was announced, Mr. Maharis released a statement where he said that the settlement recognized that it wasn't up to Citi's high standards, but that he asserted it also showed there was no evidence of market manipulation. Was that your view as well, that it wasn't really market manipulation, that it was something else?
Be honest with you, given the level of detail that the UK FSA had gone through the transaction, they not only had link letters look at it, they themselves did specific reviews on the transaction. They had a privy to a lot more detailed information than we had. And so given the fact that they, in their view, it did not reach the standard of market manipulation from the way they looked at things, we basically were relegated to believing that as well, based on the work that they had done. And like I said, we were interfacing with them so almost daily. They were telling us where the investigation stood, who was involved, and so we felt comfortable that they did a sufficient job. Yeah, and even our legal staff was involved to some extent.
So, yeah. So in our in our conversations with the OCC, some of those folks have been on the city team for quite a duration. Others sort of have rotated off and come back on. But at the senior levels, they describe how sort of post the Travelers merger, once the investment banking guys came in, and once Reed left shortly after the merger with Travelers, that there was a difference in the culture at Citi, that they were more, they had a larger risk appetite than other large sort of pure commercial banks. But how do you see that? I mean, you know, you're telling me that the aggregate VAR was pretty low, so maybe their risk appetite wasn't market risk, but did you see, compared to other similarly sized financial institutions that didn't have an investment banking culture in its board membership, did you see any difference here?
I mean, if they're, I don't want to surmise what they were thinking, but if they're looking at the Citi had this culture of trying to be number one in league tables, and that was a big driver. It was almost like every league table they were trying to be number one, which in and of itself, as long as you have prudent controls in place, is not necessarily a bad thing. I think what I started to see, I guess, in early 05 was the risk-taking was starting to get ahead of some of the infrastructure. And they were growing businesses like gangbusters, and the way our process works, in order to try to get a handle on some of that risk, I usually would tap our risk side of the house to come in and have examiners drill down into detail. I had heard of discussions in terms of, you know, the culture being sort of the old Solomon Brothers versus the Citi culture. It was, you know, I can't say that it wasn't there. More rumor. I can't say that specifically. I saw instances where they clearly said us versus them.
Right.
But I think the culture became, you know, this sort of we need to be number one, and everything started to permeate to the point where if we're going to be number one, we got to get ahead of others, and that may have caused some of the overreaching and some of the structured businesses and the credit derivative businesses. And I think in the supervisory plan I highlighted we wanted to take a look at that going forward.
Right.
Yeah.
So in looking at the some of the structured products in general and CDOs in particular, those things started going through the CMAC process, the Capital Markets Approval Committee, in the early 2000s on sort of a ad hoc basis. You know, as the new deal would come in, it would go into CMAC. One of the OCC examiners sort of likened CMAC to a bit of like the frog in a pot of boiling water, that if it starts out at room temperature and you turn the heat up generally, the frog will sit in there until it's boiling and, you know, just sit there and be cooked. And in essence, he was saying that the process was being used to just sort of continually walk Citi out on the risk curve, and that because there were so many transactions going through CMAC on an annual basis, that it didn't as effectively as it could have perform sort of a risk control function. Did you form any views about CMAC during your period of reviewing Citi?
Yeah. And I don't know if you heard this, and we had, as I mentioned earlier, we had formed a particular group or special group to actually look at structured finance-related activities. I was not personally involved in that, but I know they spent a lot of time trying to get a sense of how effective that group was, what types of transactions, who were involved in signing off on those transactions.
And who here at the Fed was in that structured finance group?
I believe, I know from my team, the person was Jane Green, but Boris Tomasi, I believe, was involved in that. And so if the question, if you ask me personally, did I actually review transactions myself? I did not.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, getting up to 2005, the document we've previously marked as F7, beginning with Bates stamp 550 to 573. It's an examination product memo, discovery review of Citigroup's complex and illiquid products. And the examination start end is August 15th to September 9th, so it was right in the transition. And it says that Kathy Voigt was the market risk coordinator, so she was your successor.
In essence, like I said, I left the team roughly August, September, and so my job was to bring her up to speed on the market risk in terms of the MIS we were looking at, different reporting we were getting from management. And I actually did, I don't know if you're familiar with our whole process, but I actually did set this review up, meaning got them to the right people in Citi's price verification unit in terms of scoping out the activity, because this was technically a horizontal that we were looking at a number of different firms across the spectrum.
Right.
And so I would say that I actually was not there when this was completed. This was actually after my time.
Right.
Frank.
That you helped scope.
I had
worked on what I call the scoping memo.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Yeah.
So, if we turn to page 7 under risk measurement, if you could just read that last paragraph to yourself.
Okay.
So it says CDOs were not included in our review. Do you recall why?
I do not specifically know. No, I don't.
Okay. All right, the next document marked Exhibit F14. Previously,
okay.
And Bates stamp 436 to 517. Now, this is something that was done once you were in your new liquidity risk role. It's a product memorandum dated May 5th, 2006.
Exactly. Yeah.
So why don't you sort of generically take a look at this to refresh your recollection? Obviously, I don't want you to read all.
Is there
pages.
Any particular section, or because I've worked on this, I'm pretty familiar. But if there's any particular section,
yeah, I have
worked on the liquidity section.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
That's what I said.
Right, there you go.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get back to the liquidity section, I have a few things that may not have been in your bailiwick, but on page 29, this document is set up as a series of questions.
Yes.
And so on page 29, question 54 says, what are the key risk factors, how are they identified, and how does the firm decide which ones to incorporate? So can you just sort of tell me, how did this group come up with the list of questions that were going to be set forth in this memorandum?
The way the process works, this would be considered a horizontal review. And a horizontal review in our lexicon is basically looking at similar type activities across a number of different large complex firms. and the area of focus was stress testing, and they were drilling down from a high level. What is the credit risk, market risk, liquidity risk stress testing that the organization was doing, both in individual silos, and then how are they aggregating it across the different silos in terms of risk? So in this particular instance, this is related specifically to the market risk related stress testing, which I personally would not have worked on. Like I said, I actually personally worked on the liquidity related stress testing at that point.
Right. But in your prior
right.
life, you would have worked on the market risk sort of factors.
Yes,
correct?
That's true. Yeah.
So in looking at the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, like more than a dozen factors, just slightly. In looking at that, I don't see anything that sort of jumps off the page to me that would be related to CDOs.
Okay.
Is that a fair characterization, or is there something there that I'm not understanding that actually would tie to CDOs that are backed by subprime mortgages?
No, I don't see anything specific. No.
Turning to page 31, question 60 says, to what extent and how are complex structured credit exposures in ABS, CMBS, including warehouses, captured in stress measures, and if not, why not? It says complex credit exposures are fully captured in the market risk stress scenarios.
Yeah, now I will say it depends on, I'll just go through that other page, it depends on which CIB stress testing you're referring to,
mm-hmm.
because there's specific stress testing that's done broadly across the CIB, but then there may be some specific scenarios that risk managers or independent market risk managers may have been doing in relation to credit exposures as well. So this risk factor stress test may not necessarily give the complete picture of all the stress testing that Citi was doing. So there may be some credit exposure stress testing that has been done under separate cover, and that may be why they felt comfortable making that statement.
And it's possible it may have been captured, but the number would have been so low it wouldn't have been.
And that's possible. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get back to the liquidity section then. Why don't you take just a minute or two to read, starting on page 59 with the ABC liquidity backstop section.
Okay.
So just a couple of paragraphs. So did you work extensively on that?
I believe I worked on bringing it together, yes.
So what can you tell me about what you remember about Citigroup's asset-backed commercial paper program. In particular, and I understand they had several different variations, but the one I'm interested in is the one that involved the liquidity puts from Citibank that was used to backstop paper where the underlying assets were the CDOs linked to subprime mortgages.
Yeah, I don't think that this is that activity. This
would be more the commercial lending.
Exactly.
Conduit for that asset-backed commercial paper program.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Completely different area of the bank. And so just to give some frame of reference, what we were doing was trying to get a sense of the assumptions that Citi was factoring into their corporate-level stress testing. And because this was done at the investment bank, we tried to pull in or get more detail around the specific assumption related to that. And did it seem reasonable? Did it that they had adequate documentation around it, that sort of thing? And from what we saw, based on I guess the gentleman Jim Murray had put together some detailed internal modeling that they had been worked on, which had historical data going back 10 years. I think they even factored in Moody's data. It seemed reasonable at the time.
And one of the things that we've been told is that an internal treasury group at Citigroup had put a limit on the liquidity puts when they hit about $25 billion, and that the reason they did so was primarily a liquidity concern, because the liquidity puts could have been triggered not only by a change in the credit rating of the SPE, but also by a change in the credit rating at Citibank, which was issuing the puts.
Okay.
And so they were worried about having, you know, $25 billion in commitments having to be realized shortly. When you were doing your liquidity review, did the issue of those liquidity puts or the contingent funding on the commercial paper, did that come up?
That did not come up in the context of this review. I think subsequently I was gone and had heard that they had had this issue of the puts being basically put back to them.
Right.
But not in the context of this review, no, we did not have any specific discussions around liquidity puts at that point.
Was there a reason for that? Was it because they were viewed as such a minimal risk, or were they outside of the scope of what you were looking at in liquidity? What?
Yeah, I guess I would say in terms of outside the scope, in terms of what we were focused on, more the corporate lending in relation to this asset-backed commercial paper business. And the review focused on what were the major drivers that were coming out of Citi stress testing. You know, we were trying to target areas that if they did get them wrong or the assumptions wrong, where they could be a large drain on funding. And so that's why we focused to get a lot more detail on this particular area. And as you can see, in terms of this review, we tried to focus it on this at a number of different other firms just to see what the practices were.
Right.
To get a sense of who was doing a better job of modeling. And, you know, based on what we saw at the time, it seemed like they were doing a pretty good job of modeling it out and thinking through the risk.
Right. Yeah, I guess the only thing I don't understand, maybe you recall or maybe you don't, is why this particular ABCP structure you did a fairly thorough review on, and the other one you didn't.
Yeah, at this point, I don't remember exactly where those puts were booked in terms of which business line. I don't know if it would have been.
I can tell you
the derivative business or
the puts. The legal booking entity was Citibank.
Okay.
Although the business had been arranged out of CIB or whatever the investment bank, markets and bank, I'm not sure what its name was at that point.
Right. Global markets.
I can't keep those things straight. But it was the investment banking guys who had put the deal together and the conduits together. So the puts were actually on the books of Citibank NA.
Okay.
So does that, because it was on the bank, does that mean you would sort of defer to the OCC on that?
Yeah, it depends on, I know prior to leaving, I had requested a review of the credit derivative business in our supervisory plan. And doing correlation trade. I know there was a sort of a, I don't know if it was a joint review or a concurrent, we use different terminology, concurrent review, where the OCC would have focused in on anything within the bank and we would have focused in on anything outside the bank. For most part, when we would do reviews that straddle both legal entities, there was no thought to, you know, for example, if the OCC was the lead, you wouldn't just stop the risk or looking at the risk because it was outside of the bank. So if you were reviewing the business and they were booking that, you'd have to, because that's how they would manage it in terms of risk measurement. And
right.
So it almost, you know, if you try to look at the business and just say, oh, I'm going to look at what's in the bank, you're not going to get a full picture of the risk that they're taking. So you have to look outside both legal entities, even though in letters they might just comment. Folks may just comment that we reviewed this business in the bank.
Right.
But you have to look broadly. There's no way you could just say, I'm just going to stop here, because that's not how the firm would manage the risk. Because they would basically tell you, not looking at offsetting trades, we've got hedges in these vehicles that really bring down the risk. So you really have to go beyond just the legal vehicle.
So once we got into the big liquidity event in 08, what observations did you have about Citigroup at that point?
Oh, wow.
Big question.
What observations? I would say that I was surprised to the extent that they had problems to the magnitude that they did. And of course, you know, having been there, you always think, you know, was there anything that I could have done differently, or there's something that I could have identified that might have stopped them from ratcheting up certain businesses if I had highlighted it sooner. I was fairly comfortable. I am still comfortable today that given the facts that I saw at the time based on what I was reviewing, that I had pinpointed where I thought the bigger risks, because part of our job was to identify independently from the firm what we saw were the risk areas so that we could focus our own attention and not just rely on what the firm was telling us.
Right.
And so as I said, I sort of left after identifying those areas. So I don't want to speak to what happened after I left, but I think looking back at it, I feel good. I sleep well at night knowing that I did at least highlight some things. Would it have necessarily stopped the firm? I'm not sure about that.
And just to clarify, what things did you highlight back then?
In our supervisory process, which is an annual process, you have to, in your particular risk area, you have to bring to discussion the areas of focus you think need to either get more attention from an examination mm-hmm. or supervisory attention. In our plan, I believe I had highlighted the credit derivative business because of the growth. Credit/structured products. I think, as I mentioned earlier, the operations were getting woefully behind the number of the amount of activity they were taking. I think I highlighted looking at aggregate market or aggregate mortgage exposure across the different entities. And then the other area was power derivatives, where the firm had done pretty well in a fibros business that they had operated, which was plain vanilla commodities, but they wanted to, again, going for that number one in the league tables, they were saying that we want to get heavily into this area, and I had highlighted that as an area of potential concern, given that there's a lot of specialized risk related to that, so... So I guess the question, sitting in 08, I was surprised, because based on what we had, you know, seen in terms of the risk management. We thought they had some challenges. We thought management was taking steps to fix things, but you know, I guess when the market turned around, everyone sort of was caught off by surprise. So.
Right. And in risk management, been like Murray Barnes. Was he the person you would have been interacting with?
Just to give you some context, what we would do on a quarterly basis, and I did this in conjunction with the OCC representatives, was basically meet with the independent market risk function on a quarterly basis. So mm-hmm. there would have been folks like Gary Mandelblatt, Murray Barnes, B.B. Duke, who was the market risk head at the time. And this gets back to not looking at the businesses within legal vehicles, because a lot of the activity crossed, so I would go with the OCC counterparts so we would hear firsthand what's going on in credit derivatives versus equity derivatives, that some of it technically was not inside the bank. So we were all hearing, you know, the risk-taking from the independent market risk function, so we would have talked with him throughout the time that I was there.
Okay. That's, like I said, this was going to be pretty brief.
Okay. Really brief.
If there's anything else from your ladder experience that you'd like to add to sort of supplement our understanding of the liquidity shocks that hit the financial system, you're pretty well situated to be a commentator on that. So if there's anything you'd like to say in general.
I guess, are you asking from given what I do now in terms of liquidity or funding?
Beyond this city, just sort of looking at the financial structure as a whole and the way we, you know, have our institutions operating and regulated and, you know, the whole ball of wax, basically. Is there any sort of big picture issue that you think needs to be thought about or needs to be examined? Or since we've all learned that, you know, it's not just capital, it's liquidity that's
right
important in a financial crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, I given the stresses that firms were under in terms of, you know, the money funds and folks just, you know, the extent to which folks were just taking their money out of the firms, it was almost, you could have had the greatest risk management since sliced bread, and but good old-fashioned run on the bank is really not a lot you're going to be able to do when you're faced with that kind of situation. It's more of your trying to ensure your reputation at that point. And this is probably my view, not the views of the Federal Reserve System. But having that backstop, I think what happened with the investment banks, because firms knew they did not have that backstop, that, you know, it almost penalized others that didn't have the access to the discount window. So when you're having runs on firms like that, it's ultimately going to affect others. And so having in place, you know, mechanisms to allow funding to firms that are perfectly fine or not in as much trouble as someone else, you don't want that sort of contagion effect to affect the entire financial system. So, and I know the Fed used our emergency powers to provide lending. I think if we had not, there probably would have been a lot more dire consequences. So looking back on it, if there was some way to provide access to non-commercial banks that might have been able to not necessarily stop all the runs, but it maybe would have allowed time for more thoughtful action. I think you sort of got into just trying to make sure they didn't have a cascading effect of firm just dropping. So and I guess you run the risk of, you know, you don't want to have a blank check where people just feel they can come, but I think there probably should be some mechanism for to come to the Fed for some sort of assistance if needed, within reason. So, but I don't think our current structure allows for non-commercial banks to actually have that ability. So, but that's just the opinion of Cyril.
No, that's what that segment of the interview is for.
Okay.
For you to offer your own views. So it's a little after 2:45, and this interview is concluded.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks.